If you got the workbook, we're on page 16. We're looking at the book of Leviticus. A good portion of the book is addressed toward the Levitical tribe, and particularly the priests. And again, not all Levites were priests. But there is a good portion of the letter that is dealing specifically and particularly with the priests. And their duties, their responsibilities. The priests are mentioned almost 170 times in the book of Leviticus. So we see that there's a lot of connection there, instruction given to them. And being that another common word found in there is offering, or offerings, or burnt offerings, get to kind of get a picture of what's going on in the book of Leviticus. A lot of the instruction dealing with the priests and the offerings that were to be made, which if you just step back and look at the book of Leviticus, that's pretty much a good chunk of what we see there. But it's law directed not just at them, but for the people. It is the law of the priests, which that is what the word Leviticus is translated. That's what it means. But let's not forget the priests wouldn't have any duties if it weren't for the people, because these sacrifices are being offered by the people also. They've got the daily sacrifice we talked about last week, every morning, every evening, all the whole time they were in the wilderness, two sacrifices a day for that. Then on top of that, sacrifices that the people would bring, and for four or five different reasons why that they could be bringing offerings. So there was a lot of sacrifices going on, and it mattered. Here's the thing we've got to see in this. It mattered every time how they did it. As we see in chapter 10 with Nadab and Abihu, when we take it upon ourselves to say, well, I know what God said, but I think this is going to be good enough, they found out the hard way that that's not true. And while we may be under a different law today, under the new covenant, does God care how we offer what we offer to Him and what we offer? Sure, always has. I don't think that's changed no matter what the law. God has always expected that if we are going to come to Him, that we come to Him as He said, in the way that He said, and for the reason He said. Otherwise, it's going to be unacceptable. And to take any one of those parts of our offering or our service to God, if it's not right, it's not going to be acceptable. If we look here on page 16, look at quite a few passages that outline some of the duties and responsibilities, and listing some of the restrictions placed upon the priest. In the first section there, beginning with 1 and verse 5 and ending with chapter 6 and verse 7, what are some of the responsibilities that they have there? What are all those passages talking about? Offerings. And what are their responsibilities? Okay. And why do you think that is? Why is that not left? Because this let's say there's someone coming to bring an offering. He has the charge of killing the animal, but the priest has, as you said, charge of the blood. Why is that? Why do you think that might be? What? Because God said so, right? Well, that's true, but what did God say about blood? There's life in it. And number one, while some of the sacrifice could or was given to the Levites for food, the blood was not. Because blood, God forbid the drinking or consuming of blood. So He was pouring that out, and it was to God that this was being done. And in a sense, this was God taking what He had said, that life is in the blood, and this is the life being offered to God. So in that real sense, that blood is being offered to God. Now, the reason I ask on this is, what is our sacrifice? Who was our sacrifice? And And what do we always appeal to as that which forgave our sins? His blood, which was his life. And when we talk about Jesus giving his life as a ransom, his blood was that which cleanses. Again, I see some parallels between what we're reading in the Old Testament and what we see in the New Testament. And that blood was very valuable to God. One of the things that the Hebrew writer said, and I believe it's chapter 9, verse 15, or no, I'm sorry, 22, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. So this is God emphasizing what was the valuable part to him, this blood offering. God required a blood offering for sins to be forgiven. And it was no different when Christ died on the cross. You know, we see it so many times in the New Testament talking about the fact of Christ's blood being shed for our sins. Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 7 is one in particular that comes to mind. Okay, any other comments on that responsibility? Again, these being the Levites, and they were already set aside by God for His service, not just anybody could do this. And where do we see later in the history of Israel where someone get in trouble for assuming that they could do that? Anybody remember? What's that? Here, given that the priests alone were able to make this sacrifice, this offering to God, where do we see later in the history of Israel where somebody in particular took it upon himself? King Saul. King Saul. Yeah. Well, that was because he took the glory and exalted himself and not God. King Saul, though, made a sacrifice. He was waiting for Samuel to show up, but Samuel delayed in coming, and so he took it upon himself and said, "Ah, I can do this." And Samuel chastised him, and this is another time where Samuel told him that his kingdom would be taken away because of presumption. Now, if you look at that and you think, okay, only God has given only certain ones to do certain things, and if we take it upon ourselves to say, okay, well, I think I can do this and God will certainly accept this, is it any less presumptuous for us today to presume that we can go beyond what God has specified or even restricted and expect that it's going to be acceptable?
God is love, that's what I call it. People don't understand or don't want to admit to that He also will punish those that transgress.
Yeah. Nadab and Abihu, as an example, in this book, it wasn't just God saying, no, you can't do that. He had already specified what they should have done. And again, it's not a matter of, well, God didn't say not to, so it must be okay. God specified, and hopefully everybody's heard in their lifetime, at some point in your life, a study on establishing authority. When God specifies, what does that do? It excludes everything else. When God says, sing and make melody in your heart to the Lord, it excludes instrumental music. Because He specified. When God specified to Noah to make an ark of a certain length and width and height out of a certain type of wood, what did it exclude? Any other measurement? Any other type of wood? And I think we used the illustration a while back. If I send my kids to the store with $20 and tell them to buy a loaf of bread and a gallon of ice cream, and they come back with 3 gallons of ice cream, well, you didn't say not to, Dad. You know how much you love ice cream. Well, it's true, I might love ice cream, but that didn't give them the authority to do that. And they would realize that, they would recognize that just because I didn't say not to didn't mean that they could. When I told them this is what I want, they knew that that's all that I wanted. That's all that I expected when they got back. And it is presumptuous for us to say, well, I know what it says, but I think... Ellis?
Within the Lord's church around this country, mm-hmm. where their basic principles are that silence may equal permission.
Right.
And looking for liberty and, you know, going to places that seem right and maybe sound somewhat good, but, you know, are certainly liberties that are just not found fully there, but...
Yeah, that's really been a division in the realm of professing believers. I'll just put it that way. The world considers it Christianity. I don't, because I don't consider denominationalism Christianity. But as the world sees it, what they see the picture of denominationalism and Christianity. There's been a big divide on that for probably about 300 or 400 years, where one side will say, where God says nothing, we cannot act. And the other side says, where God says nothing, we have freedom. That's been a huge divide for many centuries. The problem is, when you look into the Bible, you can find out which one is right. One of those has to be right, one of them has to be wrong. They both can't be right. You can't say, out of the same item, God is silent, that means at the same time we must do nothing and we can do anything. It doesn't even make sense. So one of them has to be right and one of them has to be wrong. How do you find out? Well, you go into God's Word. And David is a great example. What did he want to do for God?
Build a temple.
Want to build a temple. Had God said anything? No. And here's the thing. He even went to Nathan, a man of God, and told him what he wanted to do. And what did Nathan tell him initially? Go right ahead. I'm sure God's going to be with you. There's a man of God even telling him, sure, go ahead. But that night, God came to Nathan and said, no. David was wrong. Nathan was wrong. Another passage in the New Testament, Hebrews chapter 7, verse 14, talking about the priesthood, that Jesus is of a different priesthood than what we're reading about here. How can he be priest of a different from a different tribe and be acceptable to God? Well, the Hebrew writer concluded, well, there must have been a change of law for that to be true, because the old law said nothing regarding a different tribe for the priesthood. It said nothing regarding that. Did it authorize it? The Hebrew writer didn't think so. His only conclusion was there had to be a change of law. And he was correct. So, silent, and this is a little thing for, I guess, only for the English language, but if you use the letters for silence, same letters as license, but silence is not license. You just rearrange the letters, it doesn't mean you've got freedom to do whatever you want. Silence means no, according to God. And, you know, again, Nadab and Abihu are a good example of that. Yes?
Further than that, you go into talking about the difference between generic and specific.
Yes, yep.
Because some people will say, well, what's the authority for using a building? What's the authority for using electricity?
You're right.
And you have to say, well, we have to determine what is specific authority and what is generic authority.
You're right. And I think there is even misunderstanding in that today. I'm hearing some misunderstanding among brethren today. Well, you guys got a water fountain back there. You got songbooks and you got these pews. Where's church buildings in the New Testament? Where are songbooks in the New Testament? Again, it comes down to being able to establish either specific or generic authority. Specific is when God specifies something that is to be done in a particular way, then that's the only way that we can be sure that it is acceptable to God. But if God says, for example, Matthew 28, verse 18, when Jesus said, go and teach all nations, did he tell us, did he specify how to go? Can I take a plane? Can I take a car? Can I ride in a chariot? Can I ride in a boat? All those ways are generic authority for how to go. Since God didn't specify how to go, I can do whatever I want. Now, in the generic, sing, there is a specific there, but it's also a generic in that how do you sing? Do I have to sing soprano? Alto, tenor? How do I accomplish that singing? Can it be done without a book? Sure. You got a good memory. I don't. And to facilitate us singing those songs in a way that is honorable to God, we have that generic authority that allows us to do that. Now, where some people have gone beyond this, they say, well, setting up this fellowship all over here and having food offered to the people on Wednesday night is a way of teaching. No, that's called eating. That is not teaching. If you want to teach, you pull out your Bible and you study your Bible. You don't pull out your plate and your fork and your knife and put food on it. That's called eating. And it's a pretty weak argument in my book. But we do need to understand how to establish the authority for what we do and what we can't do. Again, Nadab and Abihu didn't say not to. And look what happened. God disapproved, and he disapproved very strongly. And again, the statement that he made, you know, those who come to me must regard him as holy, and before all men I must be glorified. I think that's a standard that God has always established. And when we bring our service and our worship down to physical, material aspects rather than spiritual, then we are not glorifying God. In fact, I would say we're debasing God. We're bringing him down to a lower level. All right, any other comments? All right, the next passage, chapter 6, verses 8 through 13. What is the responsibility of the priests here? Okay. Constant fire could not go out. So think about this. These 40 years they were in the wilderness, all the time that they were in the land of Israel. I think the same rule applied for the temple once it was established. Constant fire. Okay, verses 14 through 23, the same chapter. Okay, grain offerings and a portion of that, basically minus a handful. That's what was put on the altar. Then everything else is for Aaron and his sons, the priests. Chapter 10, verses 8 through 11. What's a restriction? Yeah, no intoxicating, no wine or intoxicating drink. And what was the reason given there? I thought worthy of note. Go ahead. Okay. So what's necessarily implied in intoxicating drink from that passage?
You don't have control.
You don't have control. You don't have the ability to make that discernment. Although man tries to make excuses about why he can today, brethren included, about why they can't do this, you're losing the ability to make good judgment. And that's God's words. Elvis? Yeah, it's not just a matter of considering what the local laws are and what their percentage is to be considered drunk driving, for example. You're right. You start losing that ability from the first time you take. Paul?
I think you just said what I was going to say.
Okay.
But it kind of goes back to when we were reading there, we say, hey, we sang for you back in Abigail, we were in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you dance or something like that?
Right.
It is not of, what is it, 0.08%, mm-hmm. Blowing in the alcohol. It's not, that's not drunk. It's just what Elvis is saying.
Yep.
Like it's from the very first sip.
And if nothing else, you think about the example that you're setting to the world, at the very least, and not just for alcohol. There's a lot of aspects of our life that we have to think about this, that even, and I'm not saying that it's right, but let's say even if it was right, think about the example that you're setting to the world. Or if somebody in the world sees you drinking, what are they going to think about you when they see that you're a godly person or a worldly person? And again, not just for this, every aspect of our life, we need to be thinking that. And it doesn't mean that even things that are okay, we have to deny it. But we do have to be careful about our example that we are setting for the world. I remember, I don't know how many years ago, how many of you remember Anita Bryant? That's how old I am. Anybody remember Anita Bryant? Old ex-Miss America, or Miss USA, I think it was Miss America, 1964, I believe. But she was a spokesman for the Florida orange growers. And she was known, as the world would say, a goody two-shoes. She was very strict in her morals. But I remember picking up a paper one time and seeing this little one-paragraph article on the front page that Anita Bryant goes out dancing. That was the headline. Now, I'm pretty sure that whatever dancing she was doing was pretty tame compared to a lot of these things today. But the headline said it all. They were trying to tear her down, this person who's known for good morals, by saying she was out dancing. Now, this is the world's view of this. Now, to the world, they didn't see anything wrong with any kind of dancing, but they made this tie together with someone who's supposed to be moral with a certain act that a lot of Christians, at least 30 years ago or 40 years ago, thought was not good for to be involved in. And they made an assumption, well, she's being hypocritical. So think about your example. Is this something you want to get involved in? To what impression are you going to leave on people who see you? So just something to think about. Derek.
And even really the more dangerous risk is not even the impairment, it's the addiction.
Okay.
The addiction to that impairment. That is the scarier prospect longer term.
Because it
rips apart every part of your life. And it destroys you from the inside out. And so what inhibitions you were able to maintain slowly go away, other things start becoming more acceptable to you. And as you said, I think before, the scariest condemnation, though, the scariest thing that God can do us is to give us over to our sin. And we can become so consumed by it that it starts representing everything that we do and everything that we act on. I remember in college I was talking to someone, and I was pointing out all the different occasions that we come up with as a society to drink. When we're happy about something, we drink. When we're sad about something, we drink. We go to a party, drinking. We get together with someone, drinking. Our football team won, we drink. There's almost no occasion that we can come up mm-hmm. with in which drinking is not appropriate anymore. Maybe in the middle of the day during work. But
I don't know. I've seen somebody start at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. So I don't think that they see it, that they are surrounded and controlled by it. Maybe they don't view themselves as alcoholics, but they are controlled by it.
Well, that's the danger, that it has that possibility, and for some people more than others. And I would just refer you to somebody whose family's been affected by an alcoholic parent or sibling or whatever it may be, to hear from somebody who's gone through it. It's not something you want to even get close to. It's like that mud hole illustration I give. You don't want to stand at the edge of the mud hole and say, well, I'm okay, you know, just a little bit. And pretty soon you're going to be all in it, and it's going to be all over you. Paul, did I see him?
I'm sure you've ran into this, and you know, James Stridell did a great sermon on this a while back, but when someone comes up to you and says, well, Jesus turned water into wine, I'm curious what your response to that is.
Well, it's not going to be a short answer, I can tell you that, because the wines back then were not necessarily intoxicating drink as they are today. The alcohol percentage was far lower than it was back then. Now, it's not to say there wouldn't be some natural fermentation possible, but there just wasn't that high alcohol content like we have today. They just didn't even have the ability to do that.
What I always come up with as well was the purpose, and that was to clean the water. Obviously, we've got purification systems that are today that are where we don't need it.
Okay. I see your hand, Richard.
You mentioned that we need to look at our influence. Somebody may say, well, I'm just going to go get this bottle to cook with.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody you're trying to study with or set an example for, see if you go into that liquor store to buy it. They don't know you're not going to drink it.
Yep. You're right.
So
that's what you're arguing for today.
We need to look at our influence.
Yep. And I grew up in a dry county. And never had to go into a grocery store and even see alcohol until I was 19. So that's not something I had to face, but I hear it all the time. And you know where the liquor store was, the closest one was?
County line.
And we used to drive by this. The funny part for me, I used to drive by it every Sunday to go to church. Had to go by it. And there would be cars parked there from the night before, Saturday night, that somebody went there and bought and drank it on property and couldn't drive home, and so they had to leave their car there. And it was almost a regular thing. But what happened in our country when we tried to outlaw alcohol? It went underground. It became just as desired as it was before, if not more so. That's the world's thinking. We have to be different. We have to have a higher standard. The reason God said this for them is because he had a higher standard for the priests. They had to always be able to discern. I don't know about you, but I want to be that way. I always want to be able to discern between right and wrong and what's good and what's not good. Always. And I don't want to test to see what my limits are. I know that I've got my full capacity of mind right now, as weak as it may be. I've got it all when I'm in control of my mind. But if I give that away with some sort of influence that takes away my control, I don't know what I'm going to be doing. I don't want to go there. And I would hope every Christian would have the same idea, that we don't want to see how close we can get to sin. Rather get as far away from it as we can. And again, just think about the higher standard God is putting down here for his priests. We are his priests today. And we should look at the things that he gives to them. I don't necessarily think they apply to us today, but there is a lesson in there for us. Okay, next one, chapter 10, verses 12 through 15. What were they allowed? Okay. Each portion of the grain offerings.
I noticed that they had to eat it in a holy place.
Okay.
They would eat it
right. Not just anywhere. They couldn't take it out into a different location. Chapter 13, verse 1 through chapter 14, verse 57. What's being addressed in that section? Leprosy. And if you think about this, in the New Testament, we've got this one example, I believe it's in Luke 11th chapter, where the 10 lepers come to Jesus. What did he tell them to do? Go show yourself to the priests. As they went, they were cleansed. What he was telling them was a step ahead of where they actually were when he said that. Because you couldn't go show yourself to the priest unless you were already clean. But he tells them, go show yourself to the priest. And so as they're on their way, then they're cleansed by his miraculous power. But he's telling them to follow the old law. Makes sense, right? Living under the old law. Okay, chapter 16, verses 1 through 34. And which priest was to do whatever is mentioned here?
Aaron.
High priest. And at this time it was Aaron. And what was going on? Day of Atonement. Somebody give me a brief description of what happens on the Day of Atonement. What's the high priest to do? You got two goats, right? One's the scapegoat. That's where we get the term from, scapegoat. Laid his hands on it, figurative representation of sending the sins of the people out into the wilderness. The other goat he was to kill and offer as a sacrifice. Do this every year. But it was only the high priest who could do this. But that term, scapegoat, that we use today, that's where that comes from. Escape goat. Escape or remit. That term, remission, that's where it comes from. Remits means ascending away. It comes from this picture right here. Any other comments on that? Okay, chapter 21, verses 1 through 4, and then verse 11. The restrictions placed on the priests. And what about the dead? What could they not do? Couldn't defile themselves with any dead except close family members. Mother, father, son, daughter, brother. Or sister. So there's some restrictions there that even, let's just say for the common person, there were restrictions about what you could do if you came in contact with a dead person. But the Levites were restricted even further, but they couldn't even deal with a dead body except for close relatives, as is mentioned there. Again, why these restrictions? What's that? Yeah, they are set apart again for God's service, and they have this higher standard than the rest of the people, than the Israelites. They have responsibilities that they are to do according to the law given to the people. If you came in contact with this person, you are unclean for 7 days, if I'm not mistaken. But you're basically would have been taken out of service for a while.
Quarantine.
Yeah, quarantine. Good way to put it. And again, there were some rules God put down for reasons we didn't understand for centuries after that was put in place. Diseases carried on. God certainly knows a lot better than we did. Okay, 21 verse 5 and then 17 through 23 over the restrictions on their personal and physical appearance. No shaving, no bald place on the head, not to shave the edge of your beard. What else?
No defects.
And he lists blind, lame, a marred or marked face, unequal limb, a broken hand or a foot, defect in the eye, eczema, just dry patches on your skin. Or one who is, and I'm assuming that this is a natural eunuch, they were forbidden. Which I found slightly interesting because a lot of the high political leaders of that time and for many centuries afterwards, they used eunuchs in their service. God forbid it in his service. Okay, 21 verse 7 and 13 through 14, restrictions on marriage. Who could they not marry?
Divorced woman?
Or a harlot? Or, I'm not sure what the term means, but defiled woman? So there's restrictions that were put on them that were above and beyond the restrictions of the Israelites. Chapter 27, verses 8, 12, and 14. On redeemed persons, their persons or objects consecrated to the Lord, they were the ones who determined the value of the animals or their property. So if you look at all these responsibilities, how busy were the priests? Very busy. They had a lot to do. And if you think about it, you've got the tribe of Levi, smaller than most of the tribes, and not all of the Levites were going to be priests. You got a relatively small number dealing with the entire population of Israel, and all these responsibilities that we've looked at here, they're going to be fairly busy all the time. Sacrifices, but more than the sacrifices, the determination of when somebody's clean or unclean. valuation on property dedicated to God or animals dedicated to God. A lot of work involved there. Could they ever take it lightly? Could they ever take it lightly? I think that God made such a severe example of Nadab and Abihu at the very beginning. To me, that's very similar to Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament. How soon after the establishment of the church did that happen? Pretty early on, right? What was the direct result of them being both struck dead?
Great fear.
Great fear came upon all the church. You think the rest of the priests paid attention to what happened with Nadab and Abihu? It's kind of setting the tone, I think, for the rest of their service, that God meant exactly what He said, and He was serious about what He expected for those who would come near Him. So if you look at all these regulations, we find a lot of, particularly between chapters 18 and 20, about sexual relationships and the general conduct of chapter 20. What can we know about the nations that God drove out? Very immoral. They were practicing all these things. Because if you notice, when God forbids these things, He says a few times, as these nations had done, and specifying He doesn't want them to be like these nations. So you've got incest, bestiality, adultery, homosexuality. All these nations were practicing these things. And that was a long time ago. It's not anything new. Problem is now society is starting to legitimize some of these same behaviors or to consider them nothing nowadays. And we're getting back to the kind of people that God destroyed because of it. So should be eye-opening to us. So why was God so particular about the conduct and the duties of the priests?
Set an example,
right? Again, they were the ones that were working closest to God in service. And I think it would be like any position of religious leadership, the people are going to be watching to see what they're doing and how they treat God and how they respect God and fear Him. Certainly that. I think it's more than that. I think there's, again, chapter 10, verse 3, He expects honor. He wants not just anybody serving Him. He wants the best, and He wants the best service. Sure. And here's the thing. They couldn't help being born into that tribe. And when they got a certain age, as long as there were no physical defects in them, they, between age 20 and 50, they were in service to God. Think everybody wanted to do that who was born into it? Probably not. But they had to learn to love it, as you said, because this is something they had to commit themselves to, what they had to do every day. God wanted it done in a particular way. They couldn't just go at it haphazardly or casually. They had to do it right. And so it would require, I think you're right, a focused mind on doing it in a way that would honor God every time. Okay, any other comments? It looks like our bell is ringing, so we'll pick up with question 3, and then get into the text on page 18 next week.